A Biblical View of Dating, the third talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 21, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Tonight's topic is a theory of dating, and Jack will be starting off with a brief talk, and then Andrew Robinson and myself will be on the panel.
Okay, I'll try to be as brief as I can so we leave plenty of time for discussion. The most likely place where we're going to miscommunicate and not be heard is in our definition of dating. So let me be as clear as I can be about what dating is to start with, what we're talking about when we talk about dating. First of all, what I don't mean. For a man and woman to make an appointment together to meet and do something is not a date, by the definition. That's an appointment. So I'm not against appointments. So I just want to be clear about that. And then it's also the case, it also is true that dating is not necessarily what's happening when you spend a lot of time together. Spending a lot of time together in and of itself, as a man and woman, as a single man and a single woman, spending a lot of time with one another, getting to know one another and getting to appreciate one another, that in and of itself is not necessarily what's in the crosshairs of my criticism today. That's not necessarily dating. What makes dating dating has to do with a set of different factors and different realities, but primarily it's an institution in our culture, as I see it, and it's an institution based on a kind of relationship, a certain kind of relationship between a man and a woman that's characterized by a particular set of attitudes, and I'll define those in a second. But to be more accurate, what I'm talking about tonight is what we might call boyfriending and girlfriending. It's the very fact that we have this relationship that we see as socially and culturally valid, called a boyfriend or a girlfriend in the way that we mean that. That's what I'm talking about. Now, what are those characteristics that characterize that kind of relationship? Well, primarily, you can guess where I'm going to start with this. It's a relationship that's viewed as a kind of quasi-marital relationship. And what I mean by quasi-marital is it has many of the elements and features of a marriage relationship without actually being a marriage relationship. And what it lacks fundamentally is commitment. There's no real obligation. There's no real commitment one to the other. This is a relationship that's going to exist until we decide we're done with it. And then when we're done with it, it won't exist any longer. But it's a relationship where we want to mimic all of the features of marriage, the kind of intimacy, the kind of transparency, the kind of exclusivity and all that that is true and valid and right in a marriage relationship. We want to mimic all that without the commitment that makes a marriage a marriage. So a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, in the sense that I mean it, is that quasi-marital relationship. So there is the expectation of exclusivity, and with that, the expectation of faithfulness to one another. So an expectation that we belong to one another. And we talked last week in the context of what I called emotional fornication. We talked about that sense of being justified and being jealous to share that person with somebody else that goes along with that. There's a kind of expectation of total transparency, total disclosure, being totally forthcoming in my relationship with the other person, something that is utterly and completely valid in marriage, and in fact, it's what makes marriage marriage, and in a healthy marriage a healthy marriage, but is not necessarily and always appropriate in the context of a man-woman relationship outside of marriage. It's a relationship that has the attitude and takes the perspective that this relationship is one of the central defining features of my life. That's part and parcel of the boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. To lose this relationship would be to lose a core element of who I am. Now, obviously, that ought to be the case in marriage. We mimic that in the boyfriend-girlfriend relationship and adopt that attitude toward the boyfriend-girlfriend. That's different from friendship. In friendship, if I lose my spouse, I lose a part of myself. You hear that often when people have been married for 50, 60 years and their spouse dies, that they feel like they've lost a part of themselves. That's because in marriage you are committed to becoming one, to be one flesh with the other person. So there's a sense in which, obviously, psychologically and emotionally, it is like losing a part of yourself. To lose a dear friend is to lose something very dear and very valuable to me, but it's not to lose a part of myself. So they're fundamentally, radically different relationships, it seems to me. So that's the first element of this relationship, is the quasi-marital status of this relationship. A second thing is that the attitude toward the relationship is that the purpose of the relationship is to check the other person out, to see if I like them enough that I would want to marry them. That seems to be a fundamentally important feature of this relationship. We are now in a state of checking one another out. We're going to see whether we want to spend the rest of our life together. Dating, it seems to me, as I said, is an institution, so it includes certain cultural givens with respect to what the relationship will and should look like. We have certain cultural expectations about what boyfriends and girlfriends do together. So one of the problems that I'm going to argue the dating has is that it sets us up to feel the pressure to conform to all those cultural expectations. But this is not just a relationship that we as individuals invent. Our whole culture has invented this relationship, and it encourages, promotes, and enforces this kind of institution. I think because it's a quasi-marital relationship, that's why it is so difficult to, especially in our culture today, so difficult to refrain from sexual intimacy. Because there's a sense in which it feels so natural to be sexually intimate, because we have reproduced all the other characteristics of marriage. The kind of emotional closeness and transparency and oneness that is appropriate to marriage. We have reproduced all of that, and then we wonder why it's so difficult to not seem natural to be sexually intimate. That's one of the problems, I think, for dating. So because it's a cultural institution that is accepted by our society and is enforced by our society in a lot of ways, our society considers boyfriend-girlfriend relationships a valid relationship, it makes it very, very difficult for young men and young women in our culture to pursue a good friendship with no desire or intent to marry, on the one hand, or makes it difficult to pursue a good friendship in order to consider the possibility of marriage in our culture without having all kinds of external forces placed on us, moving us toward redefining our relationship in terms of, that's my boyfriend, that's my girlfriend. It's very, very difficult to resist that because it's such a strong pressure culturally. So what are the problems that I see with dating? First and foremost, fundamentally, it's based on a morally questionable relationship, namely emotional fornication, or even if not clearly emotional fornication, just this quasi-marital relationship is a morally questionable relationship, I would argue. There's really no place for it in the biblical view of sexuality. I don't think it's really a biblically valid relationship. Now, Jonathan very appropriately asked me the question last week, is this biblical? And I quickly answered no. And what I mean by that is, what I'm saying here tonight, I hope is obvious, is not something that I can take from the text of the Bible. the Bible doesn't address this. One of the reasons it doesn't address this is because the institution didn't exist in the time of the Bible. So obviously it didn't address it because it wasn't a social problem in the time of the Bible, if it is a problem at all. I'm arguing it's a social problem, but it's not one that we have any direct, explicit teaching about in the Bible. But as Nancy suggested last week, I do think we can have a biblical perspective on these things because we can take some general principles, reconstruct the general worldview of the Bible, and ask ourselves, what are the implications of that worldview toward what it is that we are doing, this institution, what it is that we're practicing, what's loving, what's right, what's good. I'm arguing that from that overall biblical worldview, it's a morally questionable relationship. Second problem is, quasi-marriages can only end by quasi-divorces. Quasi-divorces, it seems to me, can be just as psychologically devastating as legal divorces. They can take their toll and have a huge impact on the well-being and the psyche of the people involved. Thirdly, and this flies in the face of what everything in you is going to say, but Jack, how can you get to point A from point A to point B without dating? How can you go from single to married without dating? I would argue that by its very nature, dating as I've defined it, is not helpful in promoting commitment within marriage. That is, it does not take commitment seriously enough. And in fact, it trains us to not take commitment all that seriously at all. Serial boy-girlfriending, it seems to me, logically, will tend to promote serial monogamy in our culture, and I think it has promoted serial monogamy in our culture. Furthermore, it is not a valuable way to find a spouse, I would argue. In fact, it is a decidedly unhelpful way to find a spouse. And yet that's the sole reason that I think that people would give arguing for the institution, is that how am I going to find a spouse without it?
Serial boyfriend and girlfriend promote serial monogamy? Is that what you meant to say?
Yeah.
Oh.
Meaning, but what I mean by that, yeah, that's not clear. What I mean by that is a tendency to leave my marriage when I'm done with it, to go on to the next one, to leave that until I'm done with it, and then go on to the next one, and so on. Because we've been there before. We've done that.
Okay.
We've learned to leave if it gets old. Why am I saying that it's not a valuable way to find a spouse? For a number of reasons. First of all, our cultural definition of the dating relationship encourages involvement that is least conducive to getting to know the other person as a potential spouse in several respects. First of all, it focuses on the other person very introspectively, very self-consciously focuses on the other person, because remember, part and parcel of the relationship is the question, is that one the one for me? Do I want to marry that person? Is that the one I'm looking for? It takes that question and puts it up onto the front burner. That's the driving force of the relationship, asking that question. That's not the best way to know ourselves, and it's not the best way to know other people. We don't know people best directly, I think. We know people best indirectly. As we see them bouncing off other people, a third person, as we see them bouncing off life circumstances, as we see them bouncing off one occasion after another occasion in life, when they're not on their guard, when we're just watching in the wings, we see who the other person is. Much better than we are sitting there gazing into one another's eyes, asking one another, are you the one for me? Let me tell you the 10 reasons why. I mean, I'm going to act for you. If the question is, am I marriageable? Well, then let me act marriageable. Is that who I really am? Well, that's another question. And that's a completely different question. And the way we best find that out is by watching them when they're not performing to the question, are you marriageable? But when they're just simply being them in life. How do they treat waiters and waitresses is the most important question. It encourages men and women to conceal who they are from each other for that reason. The very relationship is a relationship of concealment. Because again, we're acting to try to answer the question for the other person. I think you could give too simplistic an explanation of this statistic, but it is nonetheless interesting. The statistic that's out there that says people who have lived together, men and women who have lived together before they got married, have a higher divorce rate than people who have not lived together before they got married. The very purpose of living together, so they have told us, is so that you can make sure, so that you can see one another in the everyday context of mundane life together in a marriage type relationship together, so you can see what it would be like to be married to them, and then you can make the decision fully informed about who the other person is. Well, if all these people are so fully informed, why are they still getting divorces? I would argue that, I mean, that there's a number of reasons for that, but one of the reasons, I think, is that they're still not fully informed. The person, the thing that they keep saying is, I got married to her and she changed. And I think that's really true. When we relax and we stop performing and we stop living our life to the question, do you want to be married to me? We become a different person. We become the person that we are. We will never know, and I know from personal experience, that you're never going to know the person that you marry. The person you marry is always going to be a different person than you thought he or she was. That just goes with the territory. But that takes all the rationale for this so-called dating relationship away, it seems to me, when we recognize that you don't get to know people at all, A, and you certainly don't get to know them very well in the dating relationship. The dating relationship, given our cultural expectations and the way we do dating, encourages shared experiences that are unrealistic and not reflective of real-life mundane experience. I suppose that's what living together is supposed to solve. But if you're not living together, the rest of the expectations about dating, they tend to be playing together, seeking entertainment together, recreation together, leisure time together, all the fun stuff. But you don't typically make your date to go take out the garbage together and, you know, change diapers together and stuff like that. I mean, that's not considered a cool date. It tends to encourage shared experiences that are superficial and don't allow a revelation of a deep heart commitment. Again, because we gravitate toward playing and entertainment and diversion. It would strike us exceedingly odd if someone said, I'm going on a date. Oh, what are you doing? I'm going to go have coffee and argue about the practice of infant baptism. Probably would think that was kind of an odd date. Or I'm going on a date where you go and we're going to have coffee and brainstorm whether there's anything we can do to reach out to the kids over in the Blair District. That seems too practical, too something else, but it's not a date. Okay, what's the alternative? If dating is not really the way to find a spouse and really not the way to go, what's the alternative? I think the alternative is to foster friendship with members of the opposite sex. In addition to friendship, to be co-workers together, especially co-ministers, co-servants of Jesus Christ, co-evangelists, co-ministers of the gospel. As we reach out to others and serve, evangelize, defend the truth, and so on, as we work together, there's something about how we put our faith into practice and action where you really begin to see the heart commitments of the other person. What are their values? What's important to them? What are their priorities? How important is this to them? You hopefully would begin to see that played out in action. That's one of the things. Back in the 60s and 70s, when I was your age, we did most of the things wrong. Most of what we did has wrecked your lives. and we destroyed our culture. But there's one thing I think we were doing right that I wish you guys would come back to, is we were very activistic. If we were Christians, we were Jesus freaks. We spent every spare moment pamphleting, evangelizing, underground newspapers, one sort of evangelistic thrust or apologetic thrust or service to the community kind of thrust after another, because partly because it was the culture. I mean, everybody had their thing back then, and our thing was Jesus, and you couldn't have a thing without doing your thing, so you had to do your thing. But I missed that. It happened while I was still in school. We had a class of students who came in as freshmen, and they were so boring and so dull and so dead. They studied all the time, and they wanted to be lawyers and engineers. And we had fought long and hard to have a counterculture of people who were not lawyers and engineers. Mm-hmm. And it was gone overnight. It was just washed away in a generation, not even a generation, in a class. And it's never come back. But I mean, if there's any appeal that I would make to your college students is to think a little bit about whether it's not time to change our culture, change youth culture, and bring back into that kind of activism that gets us involved in trying to make a difference in the lives of other people. Not being quite so self-absorbed, not being quite so focused on me and my life, but seeing my life as there for other people. If we were to do that, and if that were to become a part of the culture, then that gives tremendous opportunity to get to know people in a way that's meaningful and get to know the commitments of the hearts of the other people that I'm working with and find the person I want to spend my life with that way. And otherwise, being sharers of real mundane life together. I do think that's one of the advantages of living as you do here, who live in the house, living in community and shared living situation like this. You see people with their raw edges as well. You see the real person more likely. And you, as you watch them interact with other people and in community, you can actually get to know who they are and what makes them tick in a way that you're really getting to know the closer to the real them. The objection that's going to be raised, of course, to everything I'm saying is you can't get there from here. You can't get from friend to married without passing in between. That's true. You can't get from single to married without passing in between. But I don't think that justifies dating. It doesn't justify boyfriending and girlfriending. All that follows from that is that a transition will have to be made, and that's true. I know absolutely no way to make that transition gracefully. By the very nature of what needs to take place, by the very nature of what needs to happen, it's a huge transition, and there's no way in the world that we're going to be able to do it smoothly and painlessly and comfortably and without agony and without anguish and without soul-searching and all the stuff that has to go with it. It's just part of the deal. And I can't give you any advice about how you could avoid that. But I will say, making that transition was one of the most spiritually productive times of my life. I prayed more in the agony of trying to figure out whether and how and who to marry than I have ever prayed since. Because there were so many personal issues that were raised by this, and I had to come to terms with my Creator. I had to come to terms with my life. What did God want from me? Where was God taking me? Could I trust Him? Did I give way to my fears? Or did I trust the God who's in control of all of reality? And in the end, I mean, in that, the doubts, I remember, I'll end with this. I remember two experiences that where I've had incredible doubts like I have never felt any other time in my life. The first one was in the second grade when this guy came in who was having a revival meeting. I don't know if they have revival meetings anymore, but our church every year had a revival meeting. And the guy gives chalk talks and event, you know, they sing song, they sing Just As I Am for about 17 hours waiting for somebody to finally come forward. And so I, in the second grade, I finally went forward. And I was the catalyst to two other little twin girls about my age that went forward too, so the three of us were up there. And these two little girls were petrified. I mean, I was scared. They were petrified. And this guy was trying to get their name and address. I think it, in the end, I think it was so he could get money out of somebody somewhere, but he was trying to get their name and address from them. And they couldn't talk. I mean, they couldn't give him their own name and address because they were so petrified. And it was so striking to me. He got really incredibly impatient with them. And I didn't know much. I didn't understand much back then, but I knew that there was something wrong with this picture. This guy has just called me up here to give my life to Jesus, and he can't wait for them to get comfortable enough with him to give him their name. He's going to be impatient with them. Something terrible that marked me for life. But the next day, when I went to school, there was this incredible voice inside saying to me, and I look back on it now, and I think it was, I thought at the time it was the devil. I think now it was either God or me, but I thought at the time it was the devil. There's this voice inside that was saying, "You weak, wimpy, miserable little creature. You were so weak that you couldn't resist and sit there in your seat, and you had to go up forward and make a fool out of yourself and make this commitment that who knows whether you ever will be able to make this commitment and so on." I think in part the feeling was coming from the fact that I had indeed been manipulated. I had indeed been brainwashed by these brainwashing techniques that we evangelists use. So in part, it was probably somewhat of a healthy reaction. But it was an incredibly uncomfortable doubt that I was experiencing. And what was phony about it was something happened to me that day that did change my life. Something real happened to me. I really did make the commitment to Jesus that lasted and stuck with me. I had a lot of learning to do, but I think something real happened there. And to doubt that was really unfortunate, was really out of touch with what had actually transpired there. The only other time that I had a very comparable experience was the day after I asked Jody to marry me. And that same voice came back, "You weak, wimpy, miserable." And the only way I could comfort myself, but this was really important, I think, was I had to decide who God was and what his role was in my life. The sermon I ended up preaching myself, the prayer I ended up praying was, "God, I have no way of knowing whether I have made the right choice or the wrong choice. There's no way in the world that I have the foresight, the knowledge, the perspective to be able to make that decision here. I don't know if what I did was right. But God, I'm just simply trusting you that if I'm not to go through with this, and if this is wrong, then you'll find a way to bomb me out of this relationship. And otherwise, if it's right, Lord, just do with my life what you will do with my life. I know that you're in control here. I know that you will not allow me to go down a path you don't want me to go down." And even then, I didn't know then what I know now about how trustworthy God is, how meaningful it is to rest in the arms of the one who loves me more than I love myself, in a sense. But I had to teach myself something incredibly important about God that day to even survive what I had done. So, is it going to be uncomfortable making that transition? Absolutely. But as uncomfortable and as awkward and as anguish-filled as it is, it's a wonderful experience to learn to know your Creator and to come to terms with your Creator.
I'm kind of taking in your story. I hadn't heard that story in that context before. And I appreciated that. So, thanks. I was thinking about how you didn't mention this specifically, but it seems to me that part of the cultural issue that is in front of us with this question is fear of marriage. And I know you've talked about that in other contexts before, but that we kind of, in our culture, have this allergy or this idea that for a number of reasons, personal experiences, that go into that, fears about life in general, losses, whatever, that marriage becomes an insurmountable decision for people. So I wonder if you have any comments on that or...
Well, absolutely. And it was terrifying back then, and I think it's even more terrifying today. That's, I think, why it was such an important way for me to come to terms with, do I trust God or don't I trust God? Is God trustworthy? Isn't he? And the reason that was such a vital issue is because I was scared to death. And there's nothing like being scared to death to face that theological issue and come to terms with it, resolve what you think about that. And that was a tremendous time of growth for me. To begin to believe that about God, to know that about God was important. Yeah, fear was what drove it.
I also wanted to add on to, you were talking about the dating relationship not being as good a format for getting to know the important information about the person that you're considering, or in the context of what we've talked about previously about infatuation, in particular when infatuation kicks in,
right.
It's even harder to see clearly into what a person is really like. I think it's really critical that your idea about activism, by the way, that was the year I went to college.
Mm-hmm. You're going to be a doctor and a lawyer?
Yeah, right. It was when the apathy started. That was when I entered.
You go down in history as the disappointing generation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was really boring. We tried. We were trying to hold it together, but there were only a handful of us left. So I guess I just wanted to kind of add on to that and say that I think there is a self-absorption that I would like to see us move away from in this generation, in where we've gotten to, thanks to our generation. But at the same time, that process of being involved in something about your life or your mission or your interests alongside another person is a great place to discover who you are before God and what we bring and what gifts we have. And it seems like as we focus on this other person, we get distracted from finding out what kind of person do I want to be? What career is drawing me? What are the things that motivate me? What are the things that I'm drawn to? What mission is going to be mine? And so part of what I think the really important question that gets raised as we work alongside each other rather than gaze into each other's eyes is that we find out what kind of person do I want to be? And how do I go about being that kind of person even now? I think we get so focused on how do I get to where I have a life partner? How do I get to where I have a marriage? That we miss this great opportunity in between of having time and opportunity and energy while being unmarried to be involved in various activities like that.
Yeah, and good point. While being unmarried, I mean, that's the point that Paul makes about singleness. One of the things that he delights in his singleness is that he has time. He has a lot of latitude to get a lot of things done that married people don't.
So. Maybe to say it for a third time. I remember reading C.S. Lewis's The Four Loves, and he talked about person A, B, C, and D, and how when person C's not there, he learns he doesn't get that part of person D that person C brings out of him. And so he loses the entire deal. And I remember about a year into dating Emily, we did it all wrong, by the way. How not to do it. We were dating about a year, and I think we were on like a retreat for our campus ministry or something, and we were in a large group, and I remember she responded to someone in a large group setting of our social friends or whatever, in a way I'd never seen before. And I just stepped back and I was like, I've never seen that before. I can't bring that out of her, but I got to see a part of her that I'd never seen before. And I think for a split second I had some remorse, because here I was thinking that all this exclusive time together would really teach me who she was. And as I started paying more attention, more of her was unfolding in groups. And I think I was feeling some remorse that all of our alone time was really for naught in a lot of ways. And since then, I love that. I love watching her with her friends and watching her interact and seeing different parts of her unfold. And I think before marriage, that's a wonderful opportunity to be able to watch somebody and watch how they interact together. And that's I think that's just a powerful thing. The thing I lacked, I think, was just the flat-out self-control. I was lonely, and I wanted to be with somebody, and I didn't have the self-control to hold back and feel okay about who I was. And so that's what I wish I had. I really admire people that have that to this day. But that to me is the most striking thing, I think, about what not dating can offer. And as I was thinking about this in anticipation, I really was racking my brain trying to think, I know there's excitement to dating, I know you get to know some about a person, but I really do struggle now on the other side of it. I mean, it's obviously more convenient now to say this, but I don't see the benefit. I don't. And I thought I did. I really was convinced this is the thing to do. But I think, in the Christian culture I was a part of, dating was just commonplace. That's what you did. I mean, there was really, no one even asked the questions you're asking, Jack. No one ever considered, is this okay? It was just sort of, how do we do this and be pleasing to God? Which is a good question to ask, I suppose, but it never even begged or asked the question, is this even a godly thing to do, to pseudo-commit myself to a person I have absolutely no intention necessarily of following up my commitment? And that reminds me of when we were talking a couple weeks ago, Nancy, and you were talking about this I Kissed Dating Goodbye book. And you read this week. And I think we can buy into, even what you're proposing, Jack, we can buy into thinking, well, this is how to do the Jack dating. You know what I mean? You can, like, do it so that Jack doesn't frown upon it or something. I don't know. Poke Jack. I don't
know. That is the goal of existence.
But whereas in college, my goal was to maintain piety on the outside and didn't really matter what was going on the inside. But we can try and figure out how to do dating, as opposed to really asking the questions of who am I, what do I want in life, what kind of person am I? And I think those are the questions that I couldn't handle. They were so hard to ask at that time. And dating helped me not to have to address that.
Yeah, I actually was thinking of that conversation, and I did actually read that book this week, finally. I've glanced at it often before, but there's so much really good stuff in it, and yet it's infused with this understanding of life that I think is very different than what we're talking about, and I think that's a good clarification to make, that it isn't the question of how can we figure out how to do it right so that our lives will go smoothly or so that God will bless us, but rather how do we see our role even in... I mean, maybe the point isn't how do I get it right, but rather where does trusting God come in, and whose job is it to get me to where I'm going? I think that's a really big part of the question that... that as Jack started with last term on theory of marriage, marriage is this context that God puts us in to learn wisdom. And I think the goal of figuring out how to do it well and how to do it wisely is a really right goal. But from an understanding that knows that I'm going to fail at that and understands God's mercy in that process, and also understands, like Jack was saying, that God is in charge of this thing, and even in my grossest errors and mistakes along the way, He is directing me toward the cross and toward wisdom along the way. It seems like a subtle but a really profound difference. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to be able to heartily recommend that book, but it... especially by the end, it became very much kind of a how-to sort of it felt like to me with the goal of being able to definitely find the one that God has for me, rather than also what we've talked about here previously is that the one is the person you choose, and that makes them the one because you've made the commitment to them. So,
as you were talking through that, I remember it gave me a new insight, I think, because I do think that Emily and I didn't do it right, but it gave me new insight that I would rather have done it wrong and then entered marriage and had to deal with wisdom and had to deal with myself at a whole new level and choose God, hopefully, than having done it right, entered marriage and continued to think I was doing it right. I mean, that's kind of a goes without saying, but I'm, in a sense, I've learned to embrace and to whatever degree I can be grateful for the incredibly poor choices I've made. If that makes sense. I think that's when the cross really makes sense, is in light of that.
Okay. You probably have three tons of questions. So.
Since I have the microphone, I'll ask the first one. One thing that you didn't mention, which may have been intentional or not, is I'm just wondering about when you were given the list of the difficulties and the problems with dating, one of them you left out, which seemed like it was a huge impediment to building a relationship with somebody, is the physicality.
Right.
It seems to me that that physicality, being physical with somebody else, adds a lot to that issue of fear that you were talking about with, you know, our culture is just obsessed with fear of divorce, and it seems like a lot of the physical nature gets people into relationships so quickly, they end up getting married so quickly before they even know anybody else, they end up getting divorced, and thus we have our huge divorce rate. It seems like, I don't know, can you address the...
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that's a huge problem. The reason I didn't address it is simply because we've talked about the inappropriateness of sexual intimacy before marriage now. So I'm just assuming that we know that that's sexually immoral, that that's wrong. But you're right. I mean, in this context, it probably is important to address because it is a huge... It warps our perception of one another, and it prevents us from really getting to know one another. It prevents us from going deep in our recognition of the commitments, the heart commitments of the other person. So, yeah, that's a huge problem.
It builds infatuation really fast.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and in the same way, I think, as physical fornication, emotional fornication, what I think it does is when you're together, I pictured all these things just hanging, all these questions hanging in the air when you're together with this one person that you have this exclusive non-marital relationship with. What's going to happen in the future? Are we committed? How committed? All this stuff. And it totally, it detonates any sort of true, authentic knowing the other person. So does that make sense? The exclusivity, it just poisons the any sort of getting to know each other that you could be doing. Has been my observation, I think, as opposed to just being able to keep that distance, physically and emotionally.
Mental state, I guess, people get in when they're trying to find a spouse. Maybe this is not quite the Christian approach, but it's so prevalent in our society. I think it bleeds over into the Christian culture, which is the explicitly Christian pious approach would be, who is the one God has for me? You know, if I marry the wrong one, it's not going to work out, it's not going to be as fulfilling or whatever. I think the sort of secular thing that may actually be buried in the Christian question is sort of the kick the tires kind of model of, it's not the one God has for me, I want the best one I can possibly get, which means... you know, I'm trading off all my assets against all their assets, and can I trade up? I remember a friend of mine, a Christian woman who I respect highly, was engaged to be married to a man that she's now been married to for a long time, and we were talking about it, and she just very ashamedly said to me, "I can't she was trying to decide whether she wanted to marry him. And she said, I can't get over the feeling, and I just am so ashamed to even say this, but that I could do better. And I recognize that, because I think part of what we're doing when we feel, when we do this dating thing, is we're kicking the tires. We're taking it for a test drive. And that is so contrary to what marriage is supposed to be about, this idea that I am trying to find the person who the most for my money. I've got stuff to trade. They've got stuff to trade. I'm trying to get the most car for the money I have to spend. And so I'm test driving and saying, well, gee, you know, maybe I could get a lawyer. Maybe I could get a doctor. Maybe I could get a, you know, 6 foot tall blonde, you know, whatever it is you're looking for. And I think that's one of the big arguments I see against marriage, is that the attitude, the rationale for marriage, the seeing your future life partner to whom you're going to become one as a commodity and you're trying to get the best one, is totally incompatible with what marriage is supposed to be about. And so what you're essentially doing by offering this person your currency, what you have to offer, your smarts, your beauty, your money, your whatever it is you have to trade for whatever they have to trade, is you're trying to encourage them to stick around long enough till you figure out what you want to do with them, because you want to be the one who decides first that, no, we're not, you know. So show me what you got. You know, I'll show you as much of what I've got as I need to keep you around till I figure out what I want to do with you. Well, what a ghastly thing, way to start out a marriage. So, that comment aside, I have a totally irrelevant question. What I recently had a very unsatisfying conversation with a friend of mine who's a Christian, who is very much, you know, she's found the man, the love of her life, who is not a Christian. And I was wondering if you would comment. It's pretty clear when you're talking that the whole that you are assuming that whoever your life partner is, it's going to be someone who is committed to Jesus. This person, I haven't been able to persuade her that that's relevant. I was wondering if you could make some comments about, let's say I find this person who I'm drawn to, I feel like I could be committed to, they seem kind, they you know, they, when you talk to them, but the only problem is that when you talk to them about God, they're not sure, and they had a bad experience, you know, in a church when they were young, and they've kind of thrown it all over, and they're not really open to talking about it again. But everything else, they seem to be, you know, your otherwise your values match up, your tastes, they seem to understand commitment. You feel committed to them, so why shouldn't you marry this person?
It's not. Paul makes it clear that it's not like there's something wrong with being married to a non-believer if you're a believer. What Paul finds unfathomable is that you would choose to marry an unbeliever when you're a believer. That is, don't make the choice to be, as he calls it, unequally yoked. But he says elsewhere, it's not like you're unclean or your children are unclean if your spouse is an unbeliever. So if later in life you have two unbelievers and they're married to each other, and later in life one of them becomes a believer, Paul's point is, don't divorce. I mean, you know, don't leave them just because they're not a believer. There's nothing wrong with the relationship. So it's not, you know, you can't argue it on the grounds that there's something fundamentally wrong with the relationship. No, that's not the case. But when we understand the nature of marriage, and I have a choice now, I'm still on this side of the choice of who to marry, how do I become one with someone who, on the most important question of human existence, is not on the same page with me? I mean, I think that's what Paul says. What fellowship does light have with darkness? I mean, that's how he puts it. On the most important question, the question of ultimate truth, of truth itself, a guy's not sure he's for truth. And I'm going to become one with someone who may not be for truth. So I have to wonder. No, I won't go there. That's the rationale. That's the rationale that Paul gives, is that it just doesn't make any sense because of the nature of the oneness of marriage, that you would deliberately, consciously choose to become one with someone you can't be one with at the most important level.
I'm wondering what your comments are on how, as an outside person, seeing two people who are obviously interested in each other, how your views or non-views on dating, how...
Non-views? That hurts.
How as outsiders can we help them and or hurt them? I mean, specifically, one way to get at it would be like... even the use of the terms boyfriend and girlfriend, like, I've seen it both ways. I've seen it used by outside people to try to force people closer together and conform to the ways, the more cultural thing. And at the other time, I've seen people just struggling to articulate, you know, everybody else knows that these two people are sort of interested in each other, and a new person comes in and you're like, yeah, they're sort of interested in each other, and they go like, so are they boyfriend and girlfriend? And you're like, well, no, not exactly. And I mean, it takes about a paragraph to get it all out. I mean, I don't know. That's a very vague question, but can you comment on that?
Just say, why don't you ask them? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, that's part of the awkwardness I was talking about. How do you define the relationship? And, there's a lot of truth in what Nancy just said. Why don't you ask them? They don't know either. I mean, they can't find a word for it, because it's part of the confusion and the awkwardness of it is, well, they're kind of in an undefinable space right now. Who knows? Who knows who they are, what they are? That's how awkward it is. It's so awkward we can't even define it. So I don't know that there's really any solution to that. I mean, you're right. We can... And there's probably a third way that we can use it, and that is, especially if you've listened to me, you can use it with a sneer, and it's kind of a cuss word. You know, having a boyfriend. we should be kind. So we should try to be sensitive to how that language is going to put pressure or show contempt or something, and try to avoid that. And we should certainly try to be kind about that. But I don't know that there's any way to define the relationship when the people involved don't even know what it is.
Yeah, I would watch the sneers. The sneers are not helpful. And I think it is such a culturally saturated thing that part of it is even how we talk about it, as just saying, this is really different. I mean, what we're saying is really different. So we're in the minority. So.
Yeah. Okay. I have a question in that, like, I really liked what you had to say, Jack, tonight, just about a lot of the problems with dating, because I totally see them. And I guess the question that I have is, because that is the only thing we see, and that's the only thing that we're around, like, how can we do it differently? Because I don't want a formula, and I don't want, like, a how-to or whatever, but I don't even have an example of how a relationship could be conducted without these problems. And, do we send out resumes?
Well, that's creative.
Well, it's mostly up here. It's not so much, you know, what we like to do is to make clear to other people that I'm doing it differently. So we want to be able to wear it on our sleeve that it's different. That's really tempting, and I understand that. But that's not my concern, and that shouldn't be our concern, is to make sure that other people know that I'm doing it differently. I'm a radically different, you know, kind of person with a radically different perspective. It's mostly the battle we're interested in is what's going on up here. It's my perspective, my orientation, my attitude, my outlook on this relationship that where the fight needs to be fought, I think. And... So we we simply have a bunch of sermons stored away in my head that I have created, that I preach to myself on the appropriate occasions. Don't be jealous. Here's why. Don't insist on that person answering the desperate question of my life, are you for me, and answering that now. I mean, part of it is, part of what drives us is we want to know the future. And we want to know where this is going to end, and we are uncomfortable not knowing the future, so we want to resolve it. And we're looking for the other person to give me the information I need to resolve this thing and to resolve it now. So a lot of what allows us to do it, I think, righteously is just to tell ourselves, I have to be patient. If God is not telling me what the future holds and not telling me now, then I guess I don't need to know. I guess it's not for me to know. And as uncomfortable as that might be, to be willing to accept the uncomfortable state that I'm in that. So there's all kinds of little minor skirmishes of a moral, spiritual nature that I need to be battling inside to make sure my perspective is right and good and true and loving and so on. If I do that, then I don't need to worry about the externals. I don't need to worry about, okay, if we go and have pizza together, just the two of us, does that look too much like a date? I don't care. I mean, it doesn't matter whether it looks like a date. The question is, where's my head at? Now, I don't know if that...
I think it does. I mean, because I guess part of it is that you can be friends with someone for a while, but as soon as there's an interest there, and I mean, well, when there's obvious an interest between the two people and it's mutual, like, you can't just, it's kind of difficult just to keep a normal, regular friendship like you would with anyone else and just continue, like, getting to know each other. But at the same time, you don't want to just, like, get married. And so there is some... So there it seems like there is some sort of like intermediate like relationship there that that is kind of like checking each other out. And I'm just not sure how to handle it.
You're talking about when you get to the DTR.
Yes, like after right. The DTR, like because it happens
define the
whether or not.
Talk. Yeah.
I think there is, I mean, just to address, I'm just so glad I don't have to deal with this anymore. I have no idea how to answer this question. But I think the question is that struggle going on that Jack's talking about? Because that's the fundamental struggle is, am I wrestling with these questions? Am I agonizing over it? Am I making good choices in light of these really strong feelings I'm having that are consistent with what I believe and what I think is important? Again, I think going back maybe several weeks to not buying into the notion that because I feel something so incredibly strongly that I therefore must pursue it. Because that's just, those two don't add up, and yet we live in a culture in which that concept is foreign. I mean, it's totally foreign. And so there's just, I think the question goes back to, is there or is there not a struggle? Because the opposite of that would be, I feel this, therefore I pursue this. And that, it's what side do I fall on in that?
And back to what last week's conversation about how I sit with my needs, with these huge needs that I want this thing that looks like it's in front of me and I want to just jump at it. I think to keep asking the question, what's in the best interest of this other person as I pursue that and as I even think about how I'm thinking about it, how do I not promise something in how I act toward that person, what I say toward that person, how do I not promise something that I'm not ready to promise? I think that's a really important question. So even the DTR can be a really destructive way of me saying, I want you to answer this huge question for me. And it's not their place to answer it necessarily. So proceeding in that direction, I think we just want to be really careful with each other. And like Andrew is saying, be willing to wait, be willing to be patient, to see what God does with what's happening as we pursue a friendship. And as we, you know, as you kind of, the way you described it, I think it's true. It's like it, we gain intensity with each other as we get to know each other, especially if there's a mutual attraction. And if we can just kind of be really cautious about that intensity that's gaining and slow it down, make decisions that don't encourage a premature level of intimacy, I think that that's a really wise direction.
That's where our fears come in, of course. We're afraid that if I don't communicate adequate interest, they're going to go away. And that's where God comes into the picture. Our prayer is, God, don't let anything get away from me that's not supposed to get away from me. And we either trust that He will do that, that He won't allow that, or we don't trust. We either take it into our own hands, or we trust that the Creator of my being is going to do right by me. And that's a huge question. That's very important. Otherwise, we end up trying to manipulate.
And being loving is the right thing to do.
If I could just throw out a practical suggestion, I mean, this is totally off the cuff, but I think if it was a situation where two people knew that they were interested in each other, but also were wrestling with where do we go from here, I think it would be interesting if they felt comfortable to have a third party of someone that they felt like was wise and could guide them and give them
a matchmaker.
There you go. Catch me a catch. And
say it.
Don't tempt me. And dance. And, but I think that would be really interesting. But someone that could sort of bring, because I think the whole deal is here is that when you get into that type of a situation, you start losing objectivity. And you're so driven by these questions and these feelings that you lose your sense of where are we and where are we going. And a third party, someone who's wise and maybe has been through that, that can give some sort of objectivity to the situation, can really help to diffuse these strong pulsing emotions that are going on.
You're just trying to create a whole new field, courtship counseling.
It works. There you go.
And certainly I think that's appropriate for individuals to, I mean, you're having these big needs and these big strong feelings. Talk to somebody that you trust and work through the process some of that with another person because we need each other.
So. I have one last question, and if it's too long, then you can answer it for me after class. But just Andrew, like, when you say that you wish you'd done it differently or that you did it all wrong, how would you do it differently?
I would do probably something like what I just said, but I mean, I just wasn't that type of a person that had, I mean, I was not, I hadn't been a Christian very long, and I just didn't have that sense of self-awareness and self-control, and it was just, I was driven by feelings. What I felt like, I pursued, and that's what I did. How I would do it differently? If I could do it all over again, I might do something like that, where I mean, there was a period right away where, you know, you hear through the grapevine, oh, Emily likes Andrew, and Andrew likes Emily, and what are we going to do here? And then we had this magical moment where we met in the chapel. It was like this serendipitous moment. I'm not kidding. And but, like, if I could have sort of put brackets around that time and said, okay, wait, this is pivotal. Where we go from here? If I could have had the wisdom to pull someone into it and said, how do we proceed here? This is where we're at. What's the good decision here? But we just totally just went on our, as Jack would say, we rolled our own. I mean, we just went. And just whatever bits and pieces of ideas we could put together. So I think that's where I would just really look. As we got older and wanted to do the engagement thing right, I remember coming down and having dinner with Jack and Jody from Salem, and we
I told them there was no way to do it right.
But it did actually, I think it did help. I think it really did give us that objectivity that I'm talking about. That's probably what I would do. Because I think I just as a side note, I really think dating also, you miss out on some wonderful times with friends, maybe like of the same sex. I really regret in high school especially having exclusive relationships because I had a great group of friends that I really turned my back on in pursuit of these relationships. And I think that's a great thing to cash in on while you're in that stage in life. But again, it's so hard to see that when you're in it. So
that's a very interesting observation. That if you notice, sometimes marriages, when they're not particularly healthy, will do this. But marriages don't typically take you away from the world. But dating does, for some reason. Much of dating does. Makes you forsake your friends in a way that I don't think marriage does.
And I was just going to say that I think it also raises that if we're not ready to marry, then there's no reason to be dating. And that's part of the problem with dating, is that it's exclusive and it's not even about, I mean, especially for teenagers or whatever, I think, and even college students, I mean, if you're ready, if you're mature and ready to think about marriage, then it's time to maybe pursue the next step with that friend that you're attracted to or whatever. But it doesn't have to be the automatic question.
Jack, point of clarification, how did you come up with the phrase, roll your own?
Great question. Going back to Cali.
I sold cigarette papers in the store at the campus. I had to ask them what they were buying them for. But
could you just clarify for me a little bit, or actually rather go over again, sort of the in-between stage? Yes, you've been friends. You've gotten to know this person pretty well through group situations, and you've been friends with them for a long time. And I mean, like the between stage between that friendship and, say, engagement or whatever. What does that period in between look like? Right there.
Well, I would say externally I'm pursuing the friendship. Internally, I'm going through hell. Because I'm filled with uncertainty, I'm filled with fear. I mean, just all kinds of stuff is raging inside that I'm having to come to terms with. But I shouldn't take it out on her. I mean, that's for me to sort out as much as I can sort it out. And you rely on others to talk to. But I don't. But in just in terms of my action, I just pursue the friendship, I think.
Okay, thanks.
I just want to testify a little bit. I heard this talk 2 years ago, and that was when I first started coming to the study center, and I was like, these guys are nuts. I was totally blown away, but
2 years later, you know.
Yeah, and it's not the brainwashing techniques you're using. After mismanaging an experience of my own and seeing two of my best friends really struggle through trying to do the whole thing wisely, it really makes a lot of sense to me. And particularly, I think you used the analogy last time, Jack, of trying a jacket on, like shopping for clothes. Mm-hmm. Maybe it wasn't you, but I think there are people who tend to be the jacket and the people who tend to try the jacket on. And I think for the jacket people, it's really valuable to think about, I'm not going to be the jacket. Am I making sense? I know it's hard to go through getting to know somebody without some level of anguish, but it just kind of, thinking about just keeping yourself emotionally too for that person you're ready to commit to, it just, it's a really valuable ideal to have, I think.
Okay.
So, thanks.
Earlier you spoke briefly about the damage caused by quasi-marriages and quasi-divorces. Would you fill that out some, the nature of the damage?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Well, in real divorce, it seems to me that one of the fallouts of real divorce is can be a tremendously shattered self-image on one or the other part, because you have been as open as you have been and as known as you can be known by another person, and they have walked away and said, no. And you kind of wonder if you're worth anything. And a lot of people struggle with feelings of worthlessness and have a real struggle with self-worth after divorce, it seems to me. Well, I think the same thing happens in these quasi-divorces that happen, high school, college, and so on. I've given 3 years of my life to somebody and they walked away from me. What does that mean about me? Am I worth anything? Am I valuable? Now, you know, if we have gone through that, one of the things that we need to know and come to terms with is it really doesn't reflect on my value as a person, and I have to get past that and recognize that it's really not a statement about me necessarily. But it's a difficult problem, and it's a problem I should never set for somebody. I should never set out to make it your challenge to find yourself worth again. You know, I don't think I'm doing anybody a favor.
This is a question you probably can't answer, but Anne and I want to know you're ready to get married. Because everyone always says that, like, this is Heather in the back. You know, well, when you know you're ready to get married, then what? Something magical happens.
I'm really curious
about this.
Jack has a phrase that I like to quote.
Yeah.
If it's wise and I want to.
Yeah. The answer I was always given was, you just know.
See, I've always been given that. That's like the most frustrating answer ever, though.
Yeah. Not helpful.
Not helpful. Is that the answer?
Well,
I think if it's wise and I want to is a helpful answer because it takes into account two things. One is this idea that we're talking about wisdom. Mm-hmm. If I'm choosing a life partner, what do I want that life partner to look like? Mm-hmm. What does marriage need in character, in a person, if I want a successful marriage? If I want to be a certain kind of person before God, it's a commitment before God ultimately. So walking next to a person and deciding whether or not we're on the same track that way, as well as looking at character questions. There's other parts of wisdom. There's things like does this make sense at this time? Sometimes might be. I personally don't go with you need to be financially secure because that is a creation of the generation of the 80s, by the way, not our generation. we didn't give you guys that part, but I think financial security is something that, comes and goes throughout life, for one thing. So I'm not sure that's a good criterion for when I'm ready to marry. But there's questions like that about wisdom. What's wise? Then there's the question, do I want to? And I think that addresses, am I attracted to this person? Do I dig them? Do I want to hang out with them? I mean, I think that's an important piece. It's not, okay, this is a wise person for me to marry. Okay. That's a good decision. You know? Yuck. Sorry. But, you know, so I think that's why if it's wise and I want to is a good way to look at it.
Okay. I guess then just dealing with the idea of wisdom, I'm not making a defense for dating here, but there is wisdom I have gained through dating relationships that I don't think I could have gained through a friendship. I'm curious, I don't think you're going to say that's wrong, but like perhaps I went through more pain because I learned that wisdom in a dating relationship rather than with someone I really wanted to be committed to. But is that the problem? Or I mean, like, I think it's wisdom that I'm so glad I've been forced to know about myself as I look to my future and look to who I am and look to the kind of person that I really do want to commit my life to. And I don't see that I could have learned it any other way. And maybe that's just me and just the kind of mistakes I make. But, like, I'm just curious what you have to say about that. I mean, for me, even though I'm not looking to date in my future anytime soon, but, like, I can see that it's had a really huge impact on me in ways that I think are good.
I think it's one thing to be, I would agree, and that's what I was trying to say in terms of just relationships I'd had that, yeah, I learned a lot. I mean, one of the breakups in high school is essentially what I think God used to bring me to himself. I mean, huge, absolutely huge in my life. But it's one thing to be on the other side of that and say, I'm so glad for all the pain I went through. And it's another to turn to someone else and encourage them to go through the same thing. I don't think that those two add up. I don't think I would ever say, go for it. Give yourself over to another person. Watch it unravel and be at the end of your rope. And you too can be like, you know, and it's like, that's just, as much as we want God to operate in such formulas, it's just not, I mean, that's just the story you've been given. It's the story that God's given me. And I'm grateful for those things too, but I wouldn't recommend anyone else pursuing that.
And Heather, there's the transcendent question there is it right? I mean, God has used all kinds of mistakes in my life, evil in my life, to teach me and teach me profound lessons, and I wouldn't trade them for anything. But there's still there's the other question: were those moral mistakes that I made? I mean, did I do wrong when I did them? And the answer is, yeah, I think I did wrong. I learned a lot from them. I gained wisdom from them. That's part of my story. But it still doesn't make what was wrong right for me.
So are you saying that the dating relationship is the wrong, or the mistakes I made within that relationship is the wrong?
Well, my critique is that I think the institution of dating is wrong. I think it's fundamentally, it's founded on a moral mistake to start with. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Back to your first question before we leave. Let me add to it, a little bit to what Nancy was saying in the whether I want to part. What some of my teachers taught me that I thought was very wise and was very helpful to me at the time was to frame the question right in terms of what do I want here in this relationship. Instead of saying, do I want this woman, do I want to be married to this woman, it's do I want to spend the rest of my time learning to be the right husband to this woman? Am I willing to make that commitment? And that was there was an important difference there. I think it comes back to the code idea and the thing that Margaret started with saying, the shopping idea, getting the best I can get. It's not about me getting from this woman the best. It's about me making a commitment to that woman for me to be the best. And whether she's the best or not is irrelevant. In fact, that's one of the things that I had to carefully preach to myself is the question I asked myself is, okay, you get engaged to Jody, and you know, what if you next week meet this incredible woman is the perfect woman for you that you like even more than you like Jody? And what I realized is, what is it to commit yourself except to say, for the rest of my life, the worth and attractiveness of other women is irrelevant to you. You're making a commitment to make that an irrelevant issue for the rest of your life. And so the question I'm asking is, am I willing to enter into a relationship where I make that an irrelevant issue? If not, I'm not ready to get married to that woman or man. If I'm ready to do that, then I'm ready to marry. But I make it sound easier than it is. In the end, Jody and I just sat down one day and said, this is too weird. We got to get married. Well, there's so much confusion. You're being torn in so many different directions by your fears one way and your desires and the other way. You're so torn that it ultimately forces the issue. Am I willing to make that commitment or not?
Yeah. Spending yeah. your life with anybody else.
Right. Exactly.
So it's sort of like when I decided to move up to Eugene. I mean, there was a time when I was thinking about it, and then there was a time when I knew I was going to do it. And something happened in there, but I couldn't describe what it was.
How you made it happen. Yeah. Exactly.
Jack, and Nancy, well, all three of you, but two things tonight that were said, and maybe it's because I'm 46, I've been married almost 25 years, and these are the two things that seem significant at this point in my life. But one was when Nancy said, don't forget to, I'm not going to remember it word for word, but don't forget to work on your own person. And what I hear around the room tonight is this natural desire to find this, you know, who is this person going to be? And looking back to 1976, it really was important to work on who I was as an individual and not just always seeking this other person to make me whole. I mean, when you become married, then that is really what it has to look like. But, you know, young women and young men, it really is such an important time to discover who you are in this life. I mean, were you, is that what you were meaning, Nancy?
Yeah, finding my own gifts and callings and what makes me tick.
See, I think that's huge. I think that's such a big statement to be heard tonight. And the other thing is that the service of going out and doing something for society and the world, I think that's huge. And remembering back to 1976, Portland, Oregon, Union Gospel Mission, a group of us are going to go convert all the bums in Portland. And it was at a moment of seeing Mike be so kind to this really stinky, dirty bum, not knowing I was even watching him, where I saw such a kindness, a true kindness. And that is when you get to see elements in a person that you think, wow, you know, that is significant to me. So those are the two things that, even where I'm at in my life now, are big statements. And sometimes when all the other stuff gets muddled and not knowing exactly the formula to use because there isn't one, you know, hanging on to things like, who am I? And am I working on my stuff with God and letting the other stuff kind of fall?
I just kind of wanted to comment on the my thinking on I was very fortunate that I had a lot of friends that were guys when I was in high school and college age, and good friends, and it was good friendships. Not they were platonic, and before that, I also regret a dating relationship that I had that caused a lot of pain. And still this day, I mean, I still deal with things from bad choices of just entering into an emotional relationship with somebody. And I guess what my point is that I would argue, certainly God has his way of doing things, like what you guys are saying. God has his way of making good out of our mistakes. And as you said, you know, making good choices is really important, and we certainly don't want to go into making bad choices. But so I think that if we enter into a relationship and go emotionally further than what we think is right, there's a lot of risk involved. And I also know of somebody who, a man who is 50, who left his family and a great family, who is dating, and I've seen him go in and out of a relationship with somebody who he has no business having a relationship with and can't think straight because he's emotionally attached to this person. He goes back and forth, and I just see foolishness continually. And it struck me how this person who's intelligent is not using their head, because it's like you get intoxicated. And we think we are above that before we enter in. And I see how a relationship I had in high school, that I was emotionally attached and intoxicated, thinking I should help this person. And so I just think it's so much healthier in friendships. God graced me with some great friendships that I learned. Well, I certainly have a lot to learn still. So anyway, that's, I guess, my argument against dating.
Thanks.
I just wanted to say that two things. One, following on what Miffy said, that I would just like to encourage you all to think about a creative way to bring back activism somehow in the plank at Gutenberg. So I'm not sure if all of you have been discussing that, but I'd like to encourage that being added into the curriculum in some way, shape, or form.
Activism 101.
whatever. There's lots of different social issues and things, and I think it would be a fun thing for the staff to perhaps dialogue on, and anybody else that might be interested in trying to put that together. The other thing I just wanted to say, too, is that I just wanted to remind people that even the emphasis of trying to... Nancy answered the question about what Melody was talking about, that there still comes eventually this point, and Jack was explaining it, too, that where you go... You just there's no way you cannot ask yourself, could this be the person? That would be humanly impossible. And you'll never be able to avoid that question. But really, the issue becomes more. Because even if you try to figure it all out, like Nancy was saying, the book has its weaknesses, there's not a perfect thing. And so the situation is that no matter how hard you try to do it right, the other side of the coin is once you're there, it's more about doing right there. And the angst of dealing with your own moral failure and the moral failure you see in one another. And so the decision is big and really, really important, but you continue to make that decision all the time. So you never get off easy in any sort of way. It's all about trusting God, which is what Jack was saying. So it's cool on either side of the coin. It truly is all about trusting God.
I had a question about full disclosure before and engage. Well, it had to do with what Melody was talking about there's this point where I think it would be incredibly helpful to, even when people go out on their appointment and you navigate your social circle, there's still a lot of the mundane that you don't have to be living together to find out. There's a lot of mundane, like, a person could be a Super Bowl fan, an ice skating fan, all the non-moral issues that maybe somebody likes to read C.S. Lewis or spend a lot of time doing X. It's a non-moral issue. Well, maybe that was a moral issue. But anyway, do you think it would be proper at a point to almost like... when you're selling a piece of property, there's supposed to be this disclosure statement of, oh, by the way,